I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. There were demonstrations in Philadelphia and in many cities across the country last night protesting the grand jury decision not to prosecute Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson, who shot and killed unarmed teenager Michael Brown in August. Wilson was interviewed by George Stephanopoulos on ABC Tuesday night and said he had a clean conscience because he knew he did his job right and was following his training. Although the grand jury met secretly for 25 days over 3 months, the St. Louis prosecutor, Robert McCullough, took the unusual step of releasing all the evidence and testimony. Our guest, William Freivogel, has been reading through the transcripts, and he joins us to tell us what he has found. He's a professor at the Southern Illinois University School of Journalism. And Bill Freivogel, Freivogel, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Are you surprised at the anger, the reaction, the outrage at this grand jury decision?
No, I'm not. I'm not surprised. I'm disappointed with the looting and the arson. It's too bad that they didn't. Some of those folks didn't listen to the protesters who sought a peaceful protest of the decision.
As you read through this transcript, and there are a lot of pages there, what strikes you?
Well, what strikes me is that the physical evidence supports Officer Wilson's testimony as it relates to the first part of the incident when there's a scuffle at the car over the gun, over Officer Wilson's gun. So this is after Officer Wilson has stopped Brown for walking in the middle of the street. He then, says he realized that they fit the description of the people who had taken cigarillos from a convenience store a few minutes earlier. He confronts them, Brown, and when he tries to get out, when Officer Wilson tries to get out of his car, the door hits Brown, and Brown apparently shoves it back. But the question that was at issue was, so did Officer Wilson pull Brown, reach out and basically sort of attack Brown, or did Brown reach into the car and struggle over Officer Wilson's gun? And the forensic testimony shows that there was blood off that Brown's some of Brown's blood was not only on the outside of the car door, but also inside of the car and on Officer Wilson's uniform. So two of the 12 shots were fired at that point within the car. So the testimony in general seems to support, and the forensic evidence seems to support Officer Wilson's account that he was, that Brown had reached into the car, that Brown hit him. There's a photo of a red mark on Wilson's face when he was later seen at a hospital. And Officer Wilson shot his gun twice, and one of those bullets wounded Brown in the right thumb, hence the blood within the car. So there's support in the testimony for that. What there's a lot of conflicting testimony about is what happened after Brown started fleeing, and even more importantly, what happened after Brown turned around. So Brown runs away. Wilson gets out in pursuit. And at some point, Brown turns around. Wilson says that's the point at which he started, that Brown started back toward him, and he, at that point, started firing. Firing five times, mm-hmm. stopping, and then firing again. But there are many different accounts of what Brown was actually doing. There are some people who say, some of the witnesses told the grand jurors that Brown raised his hands and did not approach Wilson. Wilson testified that Brown came toward him, had a really angry look on his face and was charging him, and that Wilson was backing up and firing, and that Brown fell about 8 to 10 feet away from him, so that he felt as though as though Brown were within sort of a leaping distance of him at the time that the final and fatal shots were fired.
Let me just jump in here. And we're talking about what, about 90 seconds between
yes.
the stop and the actual then death of Michael Brown?
That's right.
So there's this, what you're describing is what happened in those 90 seconds. One of the quotes from the officer is that he, and apparently they're pretty much the same size, over 6 feet and I think well into 200 pounds, is that he felt like a child, like a five-year-old who was fighting Hulk Hogan.
Right.
A sense that this was a very imbalanced or uneven fight. What do you make of that?
Well, I think you're right in saying that they're both, Wilson was 6'4", Brown 6'5", Wilson about 200, Brown closer to 300. I think that Wilson, in the first part of the encounter, when Wilson was sort of trapped in his police car and Brown was reaching in the window, I think that probably Brown's greater size and sort of leverage advantage probably could make Officer Wilson fearful. I guess he says he was struck twice and feared neither of the punches had really hit him squarely. He was afraid of what would happen if there was a square punch. That's when he says he pulled out his gun in reaction to that force. I don't think the imbalance is quite as big as we thought before the grand jury. I mean, I had actually been operating on the assumption that Wilson was closer to 6 foot, so I was a little surprised that the 6'4" that he testified he was. So, they're both very big men, but I think that the size the location of them at the beginning of the scuffle probably did make Wilson feel as though he was at a disadvantage.
Let me ask you, because this is something that I read in a number of people who have read through the transcripts, is it seemed like the questioning of Wilson at this grand jury was friendly and helpful, and that the witnesses that had testimony that really was contradicting what Officer Wilson said was more hostile and even accusatory. Is that your reading?
Well, I would say that it didn't appear as though the prosecutors challenged Wilson. I mean, in short, yes. I don't think the assistant prosecutors who were in the grand jury room seemed to challenge Wilson's account as much as they did, say, Dorian Johnson, the accomplice of Brown's in the convenience store, or the person who was with Brown at the convenience store robbery. There are a couple of possible reasons. I mean, the reason that I think critics would cite is, well, they were trying to give Wilson a chance to tell a story and convince the grand jury, and this was bias in favor of the police officer. Another possible reason is it's very unusual in a grand jury for the target to testify. Almost always, the defense lawyer will tell the person, stay out of the grand jury, because you'll just be saying things that'll get you in trouble later at trial. So if you actually get the target on the stand, prosecutors tell me that you don't really want to be challenging him too much, because you want him to say as much as you can as possible. And so if you challenge him too much right as they start their account, they then begin to give shorter answers, and you have less to work with. So the real question is, so did the prosecutors, were there things that the prosecutors should have followed up on that they didn't, sort of obvious holes? The one other thing is that Wilson's accounts have been pretty consistent from beginning to end, from the first accounts he gave to the police right after the shooting to the end to his testimony. So there were fewer obvious conflicts for the prosecutors to pursue in their questions, whereas with all the other witnesses, they had quite a few conflicts from statements that witnesses would have given in social media, on TV, to the FBI, to county police. So they had a lot of discrepancies there in accounts that they could work with.
Mm. Did the jury ask questions?
They did ask some questions, yes. But most of the questions were asked by the prosecutors.
And the jury is made up of 9 whites and 3 African Americans, as I understand it.
That's correct. It was a grand jury that had been seated before the shooting. It was a sitting grand jury that had been impaneled in May. that racial composition roughly reflects the racial composition of St. Louis County. This is a St. Louis County grand jury, not a Ferguson grand jury.
And interestingly, and I think unusually, this grand jury was given a number of options by the prosecutor about how to decide on this case, which, and I'll be talking with our two guests waiting in the wings in more detail about that. But what were the choices that this grand jury had?
Well, they had the choices of charges were murder, first degree, murder, second degree, voluntary manslaughter, involuntary manslaughter, and armed criminal action. And then the prosecutors also instructed the jury on two defenses that Wilson was employing. One was self-defense, and the other was use of force to effect an arrest, a lawful arrest. And the jurors were told they had to have probable cause to believe that that Officer Wilson was guilty of the crime, and also they had to believe that that his defenses were not sustainable.
There are, a minute or so before we have to say goodbye to you, there are a number of other investigations. Who else is looking into what happened in this incident in August?
Well, there's the U.S. Attorney, the Justice Department. They still could file a criminal charge against Officer Wilson. That would be for violating Brown's civil rights. It's a very high bar. You have to prove that that the officer intentionally deprived Brown of a known civil right, that he acted willfully and negligent and in reckless disregard of that right. So that's the other criminal possibility. Then there's a Justice Department pattern or practice investigation underway into whether or not Ferguson has unconstitutional police practices. And then, of course, the Brown family can file a wrongful death civil lawsuit for damages, the Ferguson Police Department could discipline Wilson or even could fire him. And then there's a state licensing procedure where the state license could be withdrawn, although that's very uncommon where there's no indictment.
So do you see this case? I mean, obviously, it's raised a whole host of questions, but you see this case then continuing?
I do see it continuing. I went to Cincinnati a couple of weeks ago to see what they did in the decades after Timothy, I believe it was after a young African-American man was shot by a white police officer in 2000 and 2001. And they have done an amazing job in the subsequent 10 years of putting in a new policing strategy and bringing together the police and the community. And I'm hopeful that we can look to a place like Cincinnati for that kind of thing to implement here.
Well, William Freivogel, thank you very much for getting our conversation started. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Professor at the Southern Illinois University School of Journalism and one of a number of people who have been looking through the transcripts of the grand jury investigation into the shooting of Michael Brown. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. After hearing countless hours of sometimes conflicting witness testimony, the grand jury in the Michael Brown shooting case decided not to indict Ferguson, Missouri police officer Darren Wilson. This happened late Monday night. The decision has been met with much debate, some outrage, and many, many questions. Joining us now to explain some of the legal process that we've been hearing about, which guided this case, are two local attorneys, and let me introduce them to you. David Rudofsky is a civil rights and criminal defense attorney. He practices public interest law with the firm of Carey's Rudofsky, Messing and Feinberg. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania and co-authored a book called Police Misconduct, Law and Litigation. And David, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
Also with us is Jeffrey Lindy. He's a criminal defense attorney with the firm of Lindy and Tauber, also a former federal and state prosecutor, having served as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania and an assistant district attorney in Brooklyn. And Jeffrey Lindy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
David, let me begin with you. And what I find so unusual, I think a lot of people do, is how this prosecutor used this particular grand jury. In a sense, the numbers of days of testimony, the numbers of witnesses that they heard, the fact that he didn't ask them to come to some kind of conclusion, but left it up to them to decide whether a crime had been committed or not. Just how unusual is that?
It's very unusual. It has happened before, but it's the very rare case. The grand jury, if there's an indicting grand jury, and we should make it clear that in many states there's not even any longer an indicting grand jury. The district attorney decides what charge. So if this happened in Philadelphia, for example, it could have been that the district attorney would have decided whether or not to bring charges, and then there would have been what we call a probable cause hearing to determine whether there was enough evidence to get to trial. But in terms of the use of an indicting grand jury or an investigating grand jury, normally what happens is that the prosecutor has a target. The prosecutor believes that a crime has been committed and presents just enough evidence to convince the grand jury that a crime has been committed. All the grand jury has to find is probable cause, which is a very low standard.
Right.
And so in 99, probably more than that, out of 100 cases where the prosecutor seeks an indictment, the prosecutor gets it. Indeed, the courts have said the prosecutor doesn't even have to give the opposing side. They don't have to even produce exculpatory evidence. It's all a one side of the affair. So in most cases, the prosecutor seeks an indictment, gets an indictment, and then the case goes to trial. So what is unusual about this case, obviously, is that the prosecutor decided to do much more and present what he says was all the evidence, witnesses, forensic evidence, documents, and so on.
I mean, was this then a kind of a trial to you, Jeffrey Lindley?
No. It wasn't a trial. First of all, you don't have a judge, right? The prosecutor's is the
– or a defense attorney, right?
Well, the defense attorneys are outside. You know, and the witness anytime can stop and say, hey, I want to go talk to my counsel. But, you know, there's no judge. The prosecutor's sort of prosecutor and judge. It certainly was unusual. I read some of the transcripts last night based on my experience with the grand juries up in Brooklyn, New York, which are indicting grand juries, and then the federal grand juries, which are also indicting grand juries, but that do a lot of investigation. The prosecutors allow the jurors free rein to ask questions. So your previous guest talked about Dorian Johnson, and Dorian's testimony was one of the testimonies I was able to go through at some length. And there are pages and pages and pages of jurors asking questions and not asking questions. What usually happens is that the prosecutor asks the witness to step outside. The prosecutor says, okay, I'm finished my questions. Are there any questions? And a prosecutor sort of cringes in asking that because you don't want the grand jurors to ask questions. And here and then the witness comes back in and the prosecutor will rephrase the question. Here, the prosecutor allowed the jurors to interrupt. The jurors came up to a microphone, and it was – when that happens, I mean, these are non-lawyers asking questions.
Right.
And for better or for worse, this is a legal process. You know, there are rules, but they allowed the jurors free rein, which I thought was
– risky or
– I'm not – extraordinary.
But
yes, this question whether it was a trial, and it's not supposed to be a trial.
Right.
I think what the prosecutor did here was to try to suggest that this was a fair proceeding. It shouldn't even go to a trial because the grand jury wasn't even convinced that there was probable cause. And to some extent, you can defend that. You can say, okay, before we charge somebody, let's really make sure we have enough evidence before we go to trial. That's a fair principle. This officer received the benefit of that, which most people in this country would never receive. Let me just give an example.
Go ahead.
If you and I were in a fight in a bar in Philadelphia, and the same kind of thing happened.
I'd love to do that with you, David.
Right. We both had a couple of drinks.
Right.
You come at me. I think you're threatening me. We separate. All of a sudden, I see you coming at me. You've got a glass in your hand. And I'm thinking, uh-oh, she's about to attack me. It may be a reasonable belief. She's really angry at me. I pull a gun and I shoot you. I can guarantee you two things. Number one, when the police come, I will be arrested on the spot. And once the police do an investigation, will likely be charged if there are any witnesses in the bar who say, I shot too quickly.
Even if it's contradictory, but if there
even
are
if it's
witnesses?
Contradictory, there'll be witnesses on one side, witnesses on the other side. Unless it's a very clear case, it's unlikely the prosecutor's going to drop the charges in. We would go to a preliminary hearing where the only question would be, if you believe the witnesses for the prosecution, not even believe them, if they tell a story that seems to suggest I killed without self-defense, I go to trial. I may very well win a trial. I may have a good defense. So what's unusual about this, and it often – not often happens, but with police officers, they get the benefit of this kind of double protection. I'm not saying that double protection is bad, but why is it that only this officer gets it and nobody else in a similar situation would benefit from this kind of screening.
Well, picking up on that and going back to you, Jeffrey, and even going back to what Officer Wilson said, he testified that he felt that his life was in danger. He was interviewed by George Stephanopoulos. He seemed to indicate that he thought he could die because of Michael Brown. Michael Brown, yes, a big guy, apparently did not have a gun on him. Is when you're a police officer, is that the kind of defense you need in a case like this?
Well, look, David, seated to my right, is an expert in civil rights and police misconduct. I will tell you this, that as I was in the waiting room waiting to be called into your show, one of your previous shows talked to an expert from New York City, a former policeman from New York City who's now a professor, and he was talking about deadly force and when to use deadly force. And what the police officer said on the radio is, of course, you know, the absolute rule, which is that it is a last resort. So, as far as police officer Wilson, I certainly, you know, feel for him, you know, not as much as I feel for the deceased, obviously, and the deceased family. But he did much better when he wasn't talking to anybody. So his, waiting for the, you know, you're going on Stephanopoulos, he should keep his mouth shut probably, because saying that this was a justified shoot, he was not indicted, but saying this was a justified shoot, I'm not sure about that.
Well, let me pick up on that and just throw out a couple of things, and I'll toss this back to you, David. Again, we're talking about 90 seconds. Apparently, when this altercation began, he did call for reinforcements, and he did get out of his car to go after Michael Brown. And this, of course, is where things get fuzzy, if I can say,
right,
or murky.
Very murky, as the word has been used, right? And I think the critical question is not so much what happened in the car, although that could support the officer's belief that Michael Brown was very aggressive and might come at him. But what you have on the street is the officer following him. Michael Brown turns. He's not armed. The officer has no reason to believe he's armed. Often in these cases, you hear testimony, I saw some silver, I saw something I thought was a gun, but no arm. The officer is armed. And so the question becomes, how quickly do you shoot, right? I mean, it's one thing if Brown charges him and is about to attack him. He can use self-defense. He can use deadly force only, as Jeff said, it's a last resort. But he shoots while Brown is at least 8 or 10 feet away. There's all kinds of questions about whether Brown even was coming at him. Several witnesses says he wasn't. That's usually something we leave for trial.
That he might have been falling down,
May have been falling down. Even if he was coming at him, you pull your gun and you say, one more step, I'm going to shoot. Right? I mean, it's, you know, but before you pull the weapon, you still have a few seconds to do that. Brown is not armed. So there's all kinds of questions there. I'm not saying I wasn't there.
Right.
I can't give an opinion on whether this is self-defense or not. But what is unusual, as I say, is that this case even didn't get to trial, given all the conflicting testimony that was presented.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's David Rudofsky. He's a civil rights and criminal defense attorney here in Philadelphia. Also with us is Jeffrey Lindy. He's a criminal defense attorney and has served as a federal and state prosecutor as well. And we're deconstructing some of this grand jury testimony and evidence involving the shooting of Michael Brown. As you probably know by now, the police officer, Darren Wilson, in Ferguson, Missouri, not going to be charged with any kind of crime as a result of a grand jury investigation, an unusual grand jury, if we can say that. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. This note, none of us were in Ferguson, and we have read through some of this material, but we are not experts on the specifics of the case. We're really just talking about our criminal justice system and helping us understand how it works under conditions such as this. Saying that to you, Jeffrey, can we say that justice was served? I mean, the president, you know, spoke earlier in the week and said, this is our justice system. We have to allow it to work. We have to, you know, acknowledge that this is the system that we have.
Well, look, there. That's the million-dollar question, of course. And I think what's important to understand, and the reason why lawyers often, you know, thoughtful lawyers often find themselves in a bind here, is that if you do what David and I do, and I was, you know, I've done it on both sides, and there is no doubt that we have a justice system that is in trouble. There is no doubt that we have two societies. There is no doubt that if I'm a young black man in Providence, I am going to be treated very differently than a young white man who is walking around the Brown campus. There is no doubt about that. And what this whole episode indicates for our society and how we treat the lower income, white, black, any color, the lower income segments of our society. That is such a large question and such an important question. When you bring it into the legal sphere, though, then you're talking about is there evidence to charge the suspect, whether he's a cop, whether he's a street cleaner, whether he's a professor, whether she's a principal of a school, whoever they are, do we have the evidence to charge a probable cause? And if you're using a grand jury and if you're the prosecutor, am I going to get a conviction? The U.S. Attorney's Office will indict only cases where they are really, really sure they're going to win. It doesn't mean they always win. But if there is a case where there is a crime and they know a crime has been committed, but there's a problem with proof, they're not going to pursue that with an indictment. And so that's where you get the real discussion here as to people saying, well, I don't get it. Why wasn't he charged? And doesn't that indict our criminal justice system? I think our society is in trouble. Whether the criminal justice system has done its job, I think arguably you could say that perhaps it has in this case.
Well, David, going back to you and even going back to grand juries and in the fact that you've been involved in a number of police misconduct cases, I believe it was ProPublica took a look at grand jury decisions and police officers rarely ever get indicted. Yeah. Well, I mean, so is this part of a pattern?
Well, that's for sure. It's very rare, and there are a number of reasons, and some are obvious why officers don't get indicted. Remember, to get indicted, you have to be investigated. Who are you going to be investigated by? Other police or law enforcement officials, and so there's that affinity and some cognitive bias in all these situations. Prosecutors have to work with police, and so they're very reluctant just in terms of their relationship, not only with that police officer, but with the police union and other police officers. They don't do it. And as Jeffrey said, these are very hard cases when they get to trial, when you have charges against a police officer, particularly for use of force. Put aside the corruption cases and those kinds of cases, which are a little bit easier, I think, to prosecute police officers. But with use of force, the defense always is, it's a split-second decision. You want me to withhold use of force, you're going to be less safe on the street. And so it plays into all those kind of emotional, social issues that we have. So for all kinds of reasons, police are very, very rarely indicted, much less held accountable within the department. And so you have this larger issue. I mean, it's accountability, and nobody says it always has to be a criminal indictment. But oftentimes, and that's why the Department of Justice investigation, their pattern and practice investigation here and in other places is very important. Oftentimes, you can change a police culture and make it better, not simply by indicting a particular officer, but by revamping a department. Some of these departments are broken. Some of these departments are racist. And that's where you need kind of internal cultural change. And some of what the Department of Justice has done around the country has led to some changes in some departments.
Let me just do a quick follow-up with you. When a police officer testifies, does a jury generally believe a police officer? Maybe an unfair question
I think we all have the experience.
But someone in a uniform and a representative
of
the law.
I think most jurors, whether they're it's a police officer who's a defendant or it's a police officer who's a witness for the prosecution, which is the more often, tend to give more credibility to an officer, even though they're instructed not to. And so that's a reality in certainly in our justice system.
Let me go back to you, Jeffrey, and even going back to this particular case and the prosecutor essentially giving the jury the responsibility for coming up with a verdict or not. And yet I also get the feeling that he also was very much in control of what was going on inside the courtroom, I guess, in terms of the questioning of the witnesses, the evidence, and all of that. Is that a fair assessment as an outsider?
I mean, look, at this point, this is a very well-tread saying, but a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich if the prosecutor asks us to. So the person who said that, by the way, Chief Judge Sol Wachler of the New York Court of Appeals, which is the highest court. I was a DA up in Brooklyn, New York, an assistant DA when he was the chief judge. And it's so true. I mean, up there in Brooklyn, where you have hundreds and hundreds of cases indicted every week, you would have cops just sit on the stand going through their reports and the jury going indict. And in the federal grand jury, it is no different. A prosecutor controls the grand jury process. I have been in hundreds of them, maybe more than hundreds, and
I mean, so much in what David and I do is, you know, there's uncertainty, there's nuances. This is not nuanced. Grand jurors come in. It is an incredible burden. They're there once a week for 18 months. And a federal grand jury, they can be coming from 2 hours, 3 hours away. It's an incredible inconvenience. Half the grand jurors are in the back sleeping. They're reading
You mean that?
Oh, yeah. Okay. They're reading the daily news. They get up and go to the bathroom. You have some people in the front row who are very, very interested. And again, for most prosecutors, that's really scary because you're scared that a juror, they call them runaway grand juries. I mean, this is any prosecutor who's telling you the truth will tell you about the saying of a runaway grand jury. Mm. They're all afraid of a grand jury going off what they want them to do. Historically, the grand jury started for a very noble reason. I'm not sure it's being used that way right now.
But and we're almost up on our break here, but in this particular case, a grand jury was given lots and lots of evidence and testimony. I mean, does that sort of balance some of the criticism?
I don't think there's any doubt that a prosecutor controls a grand jury no matter what. But I will tell you this, with the parts of the transcripts that I looked at last night, I had never seen anything like that. Pages and pages and pages of the grand jurors walking up to a microphone, asking questions, staying at the microphone. And, you know, certainly the prosecutor, the chief prosecutor, and then the assistants in the grand jury room gave the grand jurors a lot of authority. But Dave is absolutely right. There is no doubt that the prosecutor in the grand jury controls the grand jury.
We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. That's Jeffrey Lindy. He's a criminal defense attorney here in Philadelphia with the firm of Lindy and Tauber. Also with us, David Rudofsky, civil rights and criminal defense attorney. He practices public interest law with the firm of Carey's Rudofsky, Messing and Feinberg, also here in Philadelphia. And we are talking about the grand jury decision earlier this week not to indict Ferguson, Missouri police officer Darren Wilson in the shooting death of Michael Brown. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with two Philadelphia attorneys, Jeffrey Lindy and David Rudofsky, about the grand jury decision earlier this week not to bring criminal charges against Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson for the shooting death of Michael Brown. It has been a topic of conversation for a number of months now, in fact, since the shooting back in August. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times for any questions or comments. To you, David, if you have been in that courtroom and Darren Wilson had been on the stand, and I realize that you're not up to speed on all the things that happened there, but what would you have wanted to ask him, or what would you have wanted to know?
Yeah, first of all, I do agree. I've read some of the examination of him, and I thought it was very with gloves on.
Very careful.
Very gentle as compared to some of the other witnesses, so I think that's one criticism. But as I said before, I think the critical point was where he says that Michael Brown is coming at him, the distance. I would have certainly pinned down that he knew he wasn't armed, that he himself was armed, questions about whether he said, I'm going to shoot, pull your gun before you shoot. I would really push him on all those issues. I don't think he was pushed very hard on that, and maybe he would have stood up very well. I don't know. But I think I don't think he can say this was a fair proceeding in the sense that it ended the case without a critical cross-examination of the officer who decided to come in and testify. It may well be at the end of the day he was justified. It may well be if it went to trial, then the burden is even higher on the prosecution beyond a reasonable doubt. He would have been acquitted. All of that is true. But I think even with what the prosecutor has tried to convince us, everything was out there. This was a fair proceeding. It's almost better than a trial, right? They had everything. We didn't hold anything back. I still have my questions about that process.
How about for you, Jeffrey? Then we'll get to our callers.
Yeah, I was just laughing because the prosecutor said it's even better than a trial. That's ludicrous. A grand jury proceeding is not better than trial. But, you know, I think, you know, if you're talking about some systemic questions about this, you do want to question the prosecutor who launched the investigation, the assistant DAs. deputies who were in the grand jury room were homicide. One was permanently was a grand jury. It was her assignment. It was her tour of duty, so to speak. She was a grand jury assistant. The other one who came in to help was a homicide prosecutor. When I was up in Brooklyn with DA Liz Holtzman, she had when she was one of the first in the country to do it. She had a special unit to investigate and prosecute police corruption and police misconduct. Why? Because you need prosecutors and you need investigators who are out of the system, who are out. Because if you're a prosecutor working with the cops, it is very hard to be objective. And if you're an investigator who has continues to have close ties, it's very hard to be objective. So she had and by the way, there were a lot of DAs who didn't want to go to that unit, and there were a lot of investigators who didn't want to go there, but the people who were there were walled off, so to speak, and were devoted just to investigate. And, you know, sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't, but that's at least a different idea.
Well, picking up on that, and Robert McCullough, as I understand it, his father was a police officer, actually had been killed in the line of duty. He has a mother who either was or is with the St. Louis Police Force and other members of his family. Let me throw this back to you, Jeffrey, and then we will get to our callers. I mean, does that raise some questions, and to you, David, as well, sort of whether he should have taken this case or not, or whether he should have recused himself?
Look, I'd like to think that a lawyer, whether a prosecutor or, you know, commercial litigator at a big firm, I'd like to think the lawyer can be professional and can stand outside of himself or stand outside of herself. But I do think it's problematic that this guy, it's his DA's office that works with the Ferguson police, if I understand it correctly, who prosecutes the crimes that the Ferguson police bring to him, and the idea that he's going to investigate one of his own cops, I think that's problematic.
Do you?
Yeah, I think in this case you'd probably want an independent prosecutor.
Let me get looks like Mike from Pennsauken to join us on Radio Times. And Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I actually sat on a grand jury, and well, one thing I would say is that the arresting officer almost always testified. And since we're talking about the arresting officer and the only officer at the scene of this incident, I don't see why everyone is characterizing it as unusual that he would testify.
Well, you know, Mike, hold on. Let me take that first one, and I'll toss this to David Wadowski.
Yeah, I think the reason it's unusual is that the officer was now the suspect. I mean, you're right. In almost every other case, it's the officer who brings the evidence for the prosecution, which, of course, you need his testimony to get an indictment. But here, and Jeffrey said this before, it's very unusual. It's happened before that the person who's the target or the suspect of a grand jury would actually testify. It's very risky.
Right.
If you are indicted, you've already told everybody what your story is, and that can be used against you. On the other hand, there are cases where people have done it and sometimes have avoided indictment.
Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, and the only other thing I would say is that this is, in many ways, this is a bit like Monday morning quarterbacking. We have the benefit of slow motion replay where the officer is maybe, you know, in jeopardy of losing his life, and he has to make instantaneous decisions. I think it's really counterproductive to go back and look at the slow motion replay and not look at it in real time. A lot of times we forget this happened in real time. We're talking about 90 seconds.
Exactly.
It's
a fair point, but I think one of the sort of beauty of the system is that we do get to talk about it.
I'll let David address this, but I'm frankly love football. I can't wait till tomorrow to watch the football games. But at Monday morning quarterbacking, you know, you talk about who wins and loses a game. This is somebody's life at stake, and when
Indeed.
Somebody dies, the rules change, the stakes change. And should we do money? Yes, we should do Tuesday morning, Wednesday, Thursday. We should do quarterbacking every day of the week, looking back at an event when somebody dies. But this is really this is the lifeblood of David's work.
Yeah. Well, I think there are two points here. One, just in the individual case, I think you have to do it. It's always true in whether it's a police officer or an individual who says they use self-defense. It's always this kind of seconds that happen. And yet we have a lot of people serving time in prison who claim that they shot quickly, and the jury said, well, you shot a couple of seconds too quickly. So it goes both ways. It's a fair defense. It's a fair point. It's a police officer who we give a gun to and say, protect us. So all of that is fair. The other point of this in this kind of Monday morning quarterbacking is not so much was this decision right, but does it teach us something about our system? Does it teach us something about how officers are trained? Does it teach us something about the culture of that community? I mean, one of the things that's come out about Ferguson is not so much, you know, the use of force by officers, but all the other police communities community problems. This is kind of the tip of the iceberg, the use of warrants to fund the city. There are more warrants out there than citizens in Ferguson and mainly minorities. And so it gives us an opportunity to step back and say, forget about this case for a moment, and whether that's the right decision or wrong decision, that's important. But there are even bigger questions there about policing and police-community relations that we ought to be looking at.
Well, just picking up what you said, and Darren Wilson was interviewed by George Stephanopoulos last night, and he said, you know, he was, from his perspective and in his own defense, saying, this is how we are trained. I was following my training.
Yeah, no, that's instructive.
Let me get looks like Clarence from South Jersey to join our conversation. Hi, Clarence. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Just a couple points. First off, I'm a soldier. So, you know, I listen to Darren Wilson and they talk about their use of force. But we have rules of engagement. We have use of force. And, you know, after any incident, even the combat action, whether it's a Taliban on the battlefield, civilian or soldier member, we go over it. Over and over again. So, you know, you guess who go, hey, you know, whether it's Monday morning quarterbacking, we do the same in the military.
That's interesting.
You know, my question to the panel is this, you know, why is it that prosecutors, 99% of the time, from what I can see, it may be anecdotal, would use a grand jury when it comes to a case of police misconduct versus saying, if I'm accused of, where for me it might be self-defense, but a police officer lost his life, you know, they automatically would indict. Why would the police always get a grand jury versus just going for the automatic indictment based on the information that's available?
Clarence, I appreciate the call. Both of our guests are looking at each other. I'm tossing that to you, Jeffrey Lindy.
Clarence, I would be a very rich man if I could answer that question. I think it's a point well taken. What often happens in a grand jury, and I don't think there's any doubt that some of that was present here, is that the lead prosecutor, in other words, the elected official, will hide behind a grand jury in a difficult situation. So it's a politically charged situation, or it's an emotionally charged situation. And this is a perfect example. I think he convened the grand jury, or the grand jury was already convened. He took the case to the grand jury because it gave him some political cover. And that happens, and you know, more than you would like to think, that happens a lot.
Do you agree with that, David?
Yeah, that's right. On the other hand, there is something to be said for a case like this, this high profile, to say, let's really have a fair investigation before we go forward. There are two sides here. Let's really do it independently before a grand jury, or just have our own good independent investigation. I'm not critical of that. What I am critical of is who gets the benefit of that in our system. And I think it's too often those who are, you know, law enforcement or otherwise well situated in the system that sometimes tend to get the benefit of that extra screen that many other people don't get.
Well, and even going back to you, David, only because you've been involved in so many civil rights cases also involving police and the public, and, you know, feelings are really raw today in Ferguson and in many communities across the country.
Yeah, and historically. I mean, think about the last 50 years in this country when we've had major disturbances, racial community disturbances. Almost everyone has been triggered by a police-citizen incident, shooting, use of force. I mean, there have been scores of them, and unfortunately, destruction and disturbances. So that's a flashpoint. That's a flashpoint for us, and it's a flashpoint because, in fact, historically, police have too often been oppressive, acted out of racial bias. Not everyone, most don't, but we know it even today. Look at the stop and frisk figures, right? You know who's stopped, you know who's questioned, you know who's searched disproportionately by race. And what we have to come to grips with in this country is that it still exists. It's not just that was 50 years ago. It still exists, and that's what we have to deal with.
We were talking about this actually before going on the air, Jeffrey, which was why this case, as you both said coming into the studio, I mean, this happens. But why do you think this particular case in Ferguson, Missouri, tragic incident?
I think that's an interesting question. I think part of it has to do with the facts of the case itself. I mean, there was a scuffle in the car, and there's no doubt about it, and two shots went off. And then the deceased ran. And reading through some of the grand jury testimony, he ran pretty far. And he was running down the street right? And when he was shot, he was in the street. The officer didn't stay in his car, turn the car around, follow him. The officer, I mean, he got out of his car Wild West style. So David said this earlier. It's really, really important what happened after the scuffle in the car. So I think one thing you have is the actual facts of the case where the officer, there's no doubt about it, he pursued the deceased. He pursued him. There's no doubt. And he fired, by the way, when the guy was far away. And it was the fatal shots that were when the guy was when Brown was closer. So you have that. You also have social media. I mean, it's amazing what happens. The protests that were going on last night, the peaceful, by and large, peaceful protests, were all organized all over the country by social media. So that's incredible. And look, I'm going to say something, and I may be wrong about this, but I think our country is at a critical point now, dealing with very important issues that have to do with class and with income, and have to do with race. You know, we are not in a post-racial society. Not in America, and we still struggle with these issues.
Well, and just picking up on that, I'm actually looking at some of the callers here, but back to you, David. I mean, do you think a case like this, maybe even looking at the past, a case like this can help the country deal with some of these really fraught, deep issues?
But it's hard to break people's conceptions and misconceptions about where we are, and that's race, and that's economics, and it's everything else. But if used properly, I think it can. I think this discussion is a very important discussion. People ought to, on both sides, be rethinking where they are and be open to other ideas. And it also gives, I think, as I said before, other people in the system an opportunity to start thinking about reformulating, retraining. Mm-hmm. Just in Philadelphia, for example, the number of police shootings are way down this year. That may be in part because of new training in the police department. We know that has some effect, and that's what we ought to be looking at.
I'm looking actually at Jeff. Unfortunately, Jeff, we can't take your call, but I'm going to read what the screen says. He says, does a grand jury have to be unanimous, or is it by majority? Jeffrey?
Depending on how large the grand jury is, there's a certain number. It's not unanimous. It's not one. If you have 10 people, it's not six. But there's a certain figure that it has to be. But it's never unanimous. As a matter of fact, grand jurors are lost through the course of a year and a half. You start with 24, for example. You might go down to 16.
Oh, really?
Because people have jobs to do,
families,
they have lives
and all
to
of
live.
That.
Yeah, and it looks like this was not unanimous. I think if it was, the prosecutor would have made a point of that. I think there was some dissent on this grand jury, but we don't know that for sure.
And here's my ignorance completely on display. So David, and we're almost out of time here, but to serve on a grand jury, do you get asked to serve on a grand jury?
No, you get subpoenaed.
You get subpoenaed.
it's like a regular grand jury.
This is our legal system.
We'd like you to come down here, please.
Again, showing my stupidity.
No.
But you get subpoenaed, and then you what? You serve what?
It depends. As Jeff said, like the federal grand jury sit for 18 months. It doesn't mean you're there every day.
Right.
It's only when the prosecutor needs you to come in to hear testimony.
Right.
An indictment, so it may be one day a week or half a day a week.
It's a big responsibility,
It is a big responsibility, for sure. But again, I think in 99% of the cases, it's just to have the bodies in the room. I mean, they're not serving any independent function other than to give the prosecutor a means either to investigate a case, bring in witnesses, bring in documents, or to get an indictment.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. David Rudofsky, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Good to be here.
And he's civil rights and criminal defense attorney, practices public interest law with the firm of Carey's, Rudofsky, Messing, and Feinberg here in Philadelphia. Jeffrey Lindy, thank you very much
as well. My
pleasure. And he's a criminal defense attorney with the firm of Lindy and Tauber here in Philadelphia, also a former federal and state prosecutor. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast, how to find us on Facebook and on Twitter as well. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.